Arsenic is a heavy metal that is considered a known carcinogen or cancer-causing agent. It's also associated with a range of other adverse health effects, but there is no federal standard for arsenic in food or beverages other than water. Last year, two studies by Consumer Reports found what they called, quote, worrisome levels of arsenic, first in apple and grape juice and then in rice products. A significant number of the products tested by Consumer Reports exceeded the federal drinking water standard for arsenic. The reports prompted calls for the expansion of federal standards for arsenic and also warnings that people should limit their intake of rice and fruit juice. The FDA, on the other hand, has been monitoring arsenic levels in food and beverages since 1991 as part of their total dietary study. They say their results are consistent with Consumer Reports findings, but that there's no need for consumers to change their eating or drinking habits. So how worried should we be about arsenic in our food and drinks? Should there be federal standards for these products? And what goes into setting such a standard? Dr. Josh Hamilton is Chief Academic and Scientific Officer and a Senior Scientist at MBL. His research is largely focused on the mechanisms of arsenic toxicity, and he was very involved in getting a federal drinking water standard for arsenic enacted in the first place. Josh, welcome.
Thank you.
So why do we need to worry about arsenic? What are the adverse health effects of arsenic that we know about?
Arsenic's been associated with a number of very serious health effects over the last 20 to 30 years. Traditionally, we thought of it as a poison, something that you put at high doses in food and drink, either accidentally or on purpose, and that it would lead to death within hours or days. And I think most people dismissed it as a classic poison in that sense and really didn't think about it at low levels. Beginning about 30 years ago, we started to get studies coming out of places like Bangladesh and Chile, where it was clear that lower levels of arsenic, levels that we thought were well below what we used to be concerned about, were being associated with significant increased risk of cancer, diabetes, heart disease, a number of other very serious illnesses. As these studies have progressed, it's become clear to us that these effects occur at lower and lower doses, that they occur in shorter periods of time than we suspected, and that there might even be effects in utero or transplacental effects or even transgenerational effects of arsenic that we didn't previously appreciate. So there's a great deal of attention now focused on low levels of arsenic in food, water, and other beverages.
Talk a little bit about the two different forms of arsenic. There's organic versus inorganic, and they have rather different effects in the body.
Right. Organic arsenic is either something that our body produces in metabolizing it or is produced by a chemical company, for example, as a fertilizer or as a pesticide.
And we should say this has nothing to do with like labeling food organic. This is the chemical definition of being organic arsenic.
Exactly. When a scientist says organic, they usually refer to the chemical aspect of that, which means that it has carbon attached to it. So if you took organic chemistry in college, you remember that anything that has carbon on is an organic molecule. And we're very carbon-centric organisms, so organic chemistry is very important to us. In more recent years, the term organic has come to mean natural in lay language, but we don't want to confuse those two. So the natural form of arsenic is actually the inorganic form. It's found in rocks and minerals. It's one of the most abundant elements on the earth. It's literally everywhere in the wood that we're are surrounded by here, and plastics, in rocks, in soil, in water, generally at very low levels. But our principal exposure in the environment is from groundwater. So if water is flowing across rocks that have natural arsenic in them, that arsenic will dissolve and it'll become part of the groundwater. So wells that are drilled into this groundwater will contain arsenic, sometimes at very appreciable levels. The organic forms are quite different. So our bodies and many animals can metabolize the inorganic arsenic by adding carbon groups to it. And this is thought to essentially be a detoxification process where the arsenic is then easier to excrete from our bodies when it does this. But there are also these synthetic forms of organic arsenic. One of these is called Roxarsone. It's a poultry feed additive. There are several pesticides that contain arsenic but involve carbon atoms as well, and these are the so-called organic forms.
So you mentioned that arsenic is naturally occurring. Are there man-made sources? When you talk about, I guess, some of these fertilizers and such, is that just because the starting materials already contain arsenic, or are we putting more arsenic into these products?
They're purposely containing arsenic. So Roxarsone takes arsenic and binds it to an organic molecule and The original reasons for this are different than the use now, but this has become a feed additive in pigs and poultry and cows. And then there are some pesticides that have turned out to be very effective that are organic forms of arsenic. What we now know, though, is that microbes, and in fact our own body, can break these down and release the arsenic from the organic molecule so that it's now inorganic arsenic once again.
So is there any natural role for arsenic in the body, or is it purely a toxin that needs to be gotten rid of?
Well, that's a very controversial area. There's older literature that suggested that arsenic might be an essential trace element, but one has to look at those studies very carefully. What they actually did was add arsenic at fairly high levels to livestock and their feed, and they saw, in quotes, an improvement in their health. And so the thought was, well, it must be doing something good to them. But we don't actually know, nor do we have a good way of testing whether arsenic at really low levels is essential for us or not, because it's almost impossible to get rid of all the arsenic in food. So with other trace elements like iron or calcium or chromium or magnesium, one could do an experiment where you could virtually take out all of that element from food, give it to an experimental animal, see if bad things happen to it. And then the real test is you add that one element back in at small levels and see if you can reverse those effects. All of the vitamins and essential elements in your Centrum bottle have been demonstrated in that way, one way or another, that we've taken them away, seen something bad happen, and then add it back in small quantities to see if we can reverse that. You almost can't do that experiment with arsenic, and so it's still a very controversial area.
Now, what about the adverse health effects? How certain are we about those?
We're very certain. We probably know more about arsenic than any other chemical contaminant in the world. And this is for several reasons. First, we have numerous laboratory studies that have shown this in cell culture and other models. We have numerous animal experiments that have shown this. And most importantly, we have a really growing body of epidemiology literature where we've looked very carefully at populations that are exposed to arsenic, compared them very carefully to control populations that are identical except for not having the arsenic. And we've seen a growing list of very serious illnesses associated with them that have been, and these studies have been reproduced around the world. So there's a very solid literature now on this.
So can you give us examples of some of those? You mentioned cancer and heart disease. What kinds of cancer and what other sorts of health impacts?
Well, the first demonstration of this was in Bangladesh. So in the 1960s, the World Health Organization wanted to affect the cholera problem there. And cholera was killing millions of people in Bangladesh and Bengal and East India. And the thought was that they would dig tube wells so that they would switch people from drinking surface water with the cholera in it to what they thought was clean groundwater. Unbeknownst to them, they were tapping into groundwater that was full of arsenic. And beginning several years and in some cases several decades later, people started to notice in these populations that there was an increased risk of a number of different cancers, particularly bladder cancer, skin cancer, lung cancer, but also heart disease and other problems that this population really shouldn't have. Cancer is typically a disease of old age, as is heart disease. People in Bangladesh also don't have any of the risk factors. They're not on high-fat diets. They don't have any of the other typical risk factors for heart disease or cancer. And they typically don't live that long either. The average life expectancy in this part of the world is the way it was for us 200 years ago. It's in their late 30s or early 40s. And yet these very young adults were getting these horrible diseases. And they started to associate this with arsenic exposure. And that led to us looking in other populations around the world at even lower levels and confirming these results.
I mean, you've mentioned that the more we learn, the more we see at lower and lower and lower doses. Do we know how much arsenic it takes for there to be a problem? Is there any safe amount of arsenic in the food and drinks that we consume?
That's also controversial. The tenet of toxicology is that at some point you'll hit a low enough dose that essentially nothing will happen, and that's not necessarily zero. But setting that point is very difficult, and typically you have to do a mathematical model and predict it rather than be able to demonstrate it directly. What we do know is this, that recent studies have shown that there are measurable health effects as low as 10 parts per billion in drinking water. And there are many studies that are showing significant effects at 50 parts per billion. 50 parts per billion used to be the U.S. drinking water standard until 2001 when it was changed. down to 10 parts per billion. So we're talking about very, very low levels here and levels that used to be considered safe by the EPA. So these are rather alarming studies, and there are a number of animal studies that confirm these results as well.
So then let's talk about these studies that came out last year by Consumer Reports. The first one, I believe they looked at fruit juices, and they found that 1 in 4 fruit juice samples exceeded that 10 parts per billion drinking water standard that you were just mentioning. And also, really concerningly, they did a poll of a lot of families and found that a third of children under the age of 5 were actually drinking more fruit juice than is typically recommended by say, your doctor. How concerning was this study to you when you read this, that young children may be getting pretty significant doses of arsenic, or would you say that's a significant dose of arsenic?
I believe it is a significant dose, and most health officials do. I'd like to back up and give you a little sense of the genesis of how this happened, because it's a very interesting story. The original story that broke this idea of apple juice and arsenic goes to back to a reporter at the St. Petersburg Times named Tom Marshall in 2010. He called me up that year and said that he was doing a market basket survey. He had little kids. He was curious what they were drinking. He went down the grocery aisle and grabbed a bunch of juice boxes, among other things, and had them tested by a professional lab. And he found very high levels of arsenic and lead. So he called me and said, what do you think of this? Why would there be arsenic in apple juice? And I said, well, I would expect these companies to follow the EPA standard of 10 parts per billion, but apparently they don't. But I'm a little puzzled by the lead. The only thing I can think of is that we used to use a pesticide called lead arsenate, which is, as it sounds, just lead and arsenic bound together. It was heavily used in the apple industry, the grape industry, for citrus fruits, for potatoes, a number of other very important crops, and also for cotton in this country. But I said, it doesn't make any sense because it was banned many decades ago in the United States. So he said, well, it's interesting you say that because, as it turns out, 70% of all the apple juice in the United States comes from China, and much of the rest of it comes from South America, not from the United States. And in fact, these countries were still using lead arsenate or were growing crops in fields that had previously heavily used lead arsenate. So the thought was that, in fact, these juice concentrates that were coming into the country and being used as the feedstock for making these juices were actually coming from countries where lead arsenate was still a contaminant here. Now, we haven't demonstrated that conclusively, but that was the thought. The second thing he told me was that he had had detailed discussions with the FDA about this. Why would they not follow the 10 part per billion standard? And it turns out that they just decided on their own to set their own standards for arsenic in juice and other food products that they regulate and not follow the EPA standard. They had done their own calculation and decided that a much higher level of arsenic was tolerable. Unfortunately, they don't set standards the way EPA does. There was very little transparency to this. They hadn't published that this was the level that they accepted. They didn't say how they derived this. They didn't say which scientist had done this or whether it had been peer-reviewed. This was just an internal decision that they made. And I think that most consumers would be surprised to learn that something they're drinking might have a very different level in it depending on whether it's regulated by FDA or EPA.
I certainly found that surprising. Now, let's talk about the rice for a moment. The second study then that Consumer Reports went on to do was looking at rice and rice products, and they had to do a little bit of converting because obviously juice versus water, it's pretty easy to just, you know, apply that same, as you said, 10 parts per billion standard and see whether things are above it. But when you're talking about rice, they had to do some math to convert it, and they did, and they found that indeed in this case, they actually applied the most stringent drinking water standard, which is New Jersey has a lower, I believe, 5 part per billion drinking water standard. And they found that a number of rice products were over that limit. Where is it coming from in rice?
Rice is an interesting and somewhat troubling case of arsenic in food. For reasons we don't understand yet, rice is one of the few plants that actually takes up arsenic and concentrates it at a higher level than you find in the soil. Most plants, including most vegetables and fruits that we eat, don't do this, fortunately. However, rice happens to do this, and it concentrates it mostly in the grain. So we have a plant that naturally concentrates arsenic. As it turns out, it's also being grown in regions that are naturally high in arsenic in the soil, or is grown in fields that used to use lead arsenate, where there's this pesticide applied and there's very high levels. And thirdly, it's a crop that's typically grown with its feet in the water. You've seen flooded rice paddies. And typically in these regions, they're using water that also contains lots of arsenic. So if you put all these things together, high arsenic in the soil, high arsenic in the water, and a plant that accumulates arsenic in the grain, you can see why rice would have significant levels. And it turns out that brown rice is worse than white rice because the kernel on the outside that that makes it brown rice actually has a higher concentration than the white kernel does. So this is a real problem.
Well, and one of the interesting things about this one was instead of it being a case where, you know, juice being produced overseas in China not being subject to U.S. regulations has the highest levels, in this case, American-grown rice actually had some of the highest levels, and being organic or not organically grown didn't really seem to make it any better.
That's right. And part of the reason for this is that rice is now being grown in fields that used to grow cotton down south. So I mentioned that lead arsenate was heavily used in cotton fields. So places like Texas and Arkansas, Louisiana, these are heavy rice producers now. As cotton became less of a viable cash crop in the south, they switched to other things, including rice. So they're growing this rice in fields that historically have had decades or in some cases centuries of arsenic exposure through this pesticide use. And this is exacerbating the problem. There's also species of rice that they're growing down there, which tend, for whatever reason, to accumulate arsenic more than other species.
Now, as we mentioned at the top of the show, the FDA has been testing samples of food and juice and other beverages since 1991 through what it calls its total diet study. They say their results are fairly consistent with what Consumer Reports found. But contrary to Consumer Reports really, you know, put out these reports and started advocating pretty heavily for increased federal standards for arsenic, recommending changes in dietary habits for people, and especially for what was fed to babies or young children, these, you know, infant cereals that are used with rice, the amount of juice that's used. FDA, on the other hand, says there's no problem. This is fine. We know it's there. It's at totally safe levels. Nobody needs to change what they're doing at all. How do you reconcile these very different recommendations? Especially as a consumer, it can be very confusing to hear these very different things.
It can be extremely confusing, and there's a couple of issues. One is that depending on what product you're looking at, you have at least three different federal agencies that are regulating it. EPA regulates some things, such as drinking water. FDA regulates others, and USDA regulates others. They don't talk to each other. They use completely different methodology. They use different risk assumptions. And so that's one challenge. I think the other, frankly, is that FDA has a rather troublingly close relationship with the food industry that it regulates. And I think this was clear after the story about arsenic in apple juice and other juice products broke, is that many of their press releases were virtually identical to those of the juice industry and other industries that were trying to be very defensive about some of this new information. One thing that was troubling is the statement that there's no studies showing that arsenic in food is associated with any human health effects. That's technically true because people haven't explicitly studied food versus water. But to say that, for example, somebody in Bangladesh who's eating rice that has arsenic in it and drinking water that has arsenic in it does not have health effects and that therefore it's not the food, I think is a little misleading. We know from animal studies that whether you have arsenic in food or water, your body absorbs it identically. And we've done studies in mice, for example, we've added arsenic to their food rather than their water, exact same health effects, exact same levels in their body as if it was in the water. So I think it's a bit specious to say that because we don't have explicit studies in food, therefore it's not a problem.
Now, you were involved some years back in actually getting the first drinking water standard, this EPA drinking water standard, enacted. And it was a slightly unusual case, I think. I mean, things moved very quickly, and you yourself and a number of other scientists were very involved, not just as government-requested expert witnesses in a hearing or something like that, but really as advocates saying, the science is very clear, we need to do something about that. Do you think we're at a similar point now with needing to really that we have the science and we need to really lobby for some sort of more stringent standard for food and drinks?
I think we're definitely at that point. The regulation of arsenic in drinking water is an interesting case of just how long it can take, though. When EPA was formed in the 70s by an act of Congress, Congress charged them as one of their top agenda items to change the arsenic drinking water standard. So this was in the early 70s. More than 25 years later, they had not done so. They actually then charged the National Research Council with doing the study in 1999 that led to the evidence that compelled Congress to tell EPA to change that standard. So things happened very quickly between 1999 and 2001, including some of the congressional testimony that you're alluding to, where the EPA administrator and others were citing our work as evidence that they agreed that we needed to change the standard. Having said that, the standard went into effect in 2006, and many drinking water utilities have 11 years to comply. So the wheels turn very, very slowly. I think we're at a point clearly where we have enough evidence to be very concerned about arsenic in food as another source, and that we should do two things. One is change the standards, or in some cases create standards that don't exist. And the second is to really harmonize the standards set by the different government agencies so that they're consistent and transparent to the consumer population.
Now, you mentioned that the FDA policy setting process is very different than it is with the EPA. Is there room in that process for scientists like yourself to really contribute to that process?
They do ask us for our opinion, but it's in different ways under different circumstances. EPA typically writes their own documents and then sends them out for peer review to people like me. And so I can comment on them after the fact, but typically we're not involved in the earliest stages of actually writing the documents and providing the science to set the standard. The NRC, the National Research Council, did it very differently. They actually get the very best experts in the world in a room together, and they reveal the science, and they come up with what they think are sound recommendations that they pass on to EPA or other regulatory agencies. That, to me, is a much better process because it's really taking advantage of the best expertise up front rather than after the fact.
So do we have a sense, if we were to get the best experts in the world together in a room, obviously you can't predict what would come out of that room, but do we have a sense of what the limit might be for, say, food products? Are we anywhere close to having that kind of data that we need to actually set an explicit limit?
I think so, and it wouldn't be based so much on concentrations per se. It would be based on total amount of arsenic that one would be expected to ingest in a day. So the 10 part per billion standard in drinking water is based on the idea that if we drink a liter of water a day, that produces a certain body burden of arsenic, 10 micrograms total per body, basically, for an adult. If you take that same standard and you look at the different foods, but also how much food typically one would eat in a standard diet, I think it would be fairly easy to set standards for these different food products.
How much, I guess, safety margin do you need to build into that, knowing that obviously you're basing that on average consumption, but some people are going to consume much more, say, rice, perhaps if someone is Asian or loves Asian food, maybe eating a lot more rice than others. How do you build those differences in for safety?
That's very difficult. It's true for all contaminants. This is a problem with methylmercury, for example. Some of us don't eat any fish. A lot of us eat fish, but it's fish that's low in mercury. Others of us love swordfish and bluefish and things that have very high mercury levels. So we can have a standard, but it may be applied to individuals very differently depending on their dietary patterns, and that's something we have to take into account.
Now, obviously, just enacting a standard one time is not necessarily the end of an issue. As you mentioned earlier, the original drinking water standard that was enacted was 50 parts per billion. That's since been dropped to 10 parts per billion. Do you think that drinking water standard is where it needs to be, or do you think that as research progresses and we learn more and more about these low-dose effects, that that drinking water standard may go even lower?
The NRC originally recommended 3 parts per billion in their report, and this was based on two things. One, they wanted it to be as low as possible, and they were concerned even at 3 there might be health effects, but they have to balance that with practical aspects, which is that few drinking water utilities can measure arsenic accurately below 3 parts per billion. So you can't set a standard that you can't measure accurately, or you never know whether you're actually achieving it or not. Congress, after they got that recommendation, wrangled back and forth over this, and there were political forces that said, no, it should be either 50 or 20. Others that said it should be 3 or 5. They ended up compromising on 10. It wasn't a scientific decision. It was a political decision. I believe 3 is appropriate in drinking water, and that using that standard, this would be a way to set standards in food that are equivalent to that.
So I have to ask, as we're wrapping up here, how do you personally try to control your own arsenic intake? Is this something that you worry about throughout the day? Do you eat rice and drink apple juice, or no?
I do. I have not given up apple juice or rice. I eat them in moderation like everything else. It was terrible to go to dinner with a toxicologist. I tell everybody all the horrible things they're eating. One does have to be prudent, but you have to also realize that there's risks in everything and that it's really a matter of moderation. One of the things that we've become interested in, though, is the sum total of all the things we're exposed to. I'm doing an investigation right now of arsenic in dog and cat food, because we did a study years ago in lab chow for rats and mice that showed that there's extremely high levels of arsenic in those products, because they use fish meal and other sources for protein that have high arsenic in them. And I think this is the same thing with dog and cat food, which also contains brown rice syrup, by the way, which is another source of arsenic. So I think we have to look at a variety of different food sources and really think about our total exposure. But the arsenic story goes on, and there's much more to learn.
Dr. Josh Hamilton is the Chief Academic and Scientific Officer and a Senior Scientist at MBL, where he studies arsenic toxicity. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
And we'll have to have you back another time to figure out about our arsenic exposure in our pets.
Thanks.
Thanks all for listening. This is Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Living Lab on the Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.